Oh, hey there. I'm Guy Brandon, and welcome to Pop Rocket, a weekly show peeking over all the pop culture we love to love. With me to talk TV, film, music, anything else entertaining, our digital strategist, Winter Mitchell Rohrbaugh.
Hello, hello.
Hello, hello, Winter. How are you doing?
Fantastic.
We've got very flowy garb today.
I'm just, you know, leaning into the late 30s.
I mean, it's witchy woman.
There's some tie-dye.
Super blood wolf. Wait, was super
and I'm seeing some,
blood wolf moon.
Yeah, some harem crotch going on.
Yes. Harem crotch super
Thank
blood wolf.
Thank you very much.
And we've got journalist and novelist and Canadian tuxedo wearer, Margaret Wappler.
Let me just say that I'm wearing blue denim on the top and black denim on
yeah,
the bottom.
Yeah, very bikini kill.
Which, it, yes. yeah, it makes it more like Montreal. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
I'm the cool part of Canada.
Exactly.
And we've got pop culture scholar and dyke about town Karen Toxin, who's definitely back at school because she sure is wearing a hooded sweatshirt like a university student.
Hi, Guy. Hi, Rocketeers. Today I decided to try to look like a slightly cooler professor than usual. No elbow patches. It's all like hoodie with sensible shirt and like very white sneakers.
Karen, I have a question for you as a professional academic. Do you feel as though you missed out because you've always been learning at and teaching at hot weather West Coast schools?
Not in the slightest bit. I feel like there's always a season for elbow patches. You could do it with, you could even do it with a tank top, dare I say.
Coming up on this week's show, it's a double dose of Schadenfreude. Unless you upgrade to the Cabana package, in which case you get a triple dose of Schadenfreude. We watched Hulu's Fire Fraud and Netflix's Fire, the greatest party that never happened. And our discussion is going to be the most epic discussion that has ever happened in the history of discussions if you invest now. Plus, we'll each be sharing our latest
gems. Don't forget to get the wristband.
Yeah, don't forget yes. to
load it up. You're not going to be able to get
you
want, anything.
You might want to reserve a table while we're talking. In which case, you're going to need $3,000 to $4,000. I mean, is this only giving Jesse ideas for the next Max Fun Con?
Probably.
But first, let's find out what arts and entertainment news or events have caught our attention this week. Winter Mitchell Rohrbaugh, what are you all about this week?
Oh, man. I want to give a shout out to Crashing, which is the Pete Holmes show on HBO. It's so funny. And the season 3 premiere was last Sunday. The entire episode was basically Pete fucked his way through college acts, getting booked for a bunch of college lunchrooms, and was able to hook up with multiple girls. And then he got back to New York and now is feeling confident and wants to be on the Comedy Cellar circuit. That episode was really great, and it really sort of stoked my energy about the stand-up world, which is fascinating to me. I'm obsessed with it, but I'm like an outsider to it, but I want to be inside. So I feel like this show is a slow burn and it finally kind of got to where it needs to be, and I'm like super invested.
I lost track in the first season, which isn't okay because
right.
I know everyone on that show.
I feel like those are your homies.
Yes.
So like, but really, not to pivot, I'm just too all about it because the same network and it's the same couple hours. True Detective this season is woof. It's basically mind-blown emoji. I'm like fully invested. Alan made me watch it. I was like, I don't want to sit here and watch this. It's like an extended dramatized Dateline episode, but it's so good. It's so good. And I don't know how to say his name.
Mahershala Ali
is a very competent actor. This man, first of all, he perfected the black dad 80s haircut through generations. I was like, my dad had that haircut. My dad had that haircut. No.
Is it like the perfect Arsenio box?
Yes. It's the perfect. Like,
I think
low.
My fifth grade teacher had exactly
yes.
that haircut. Mr.
It's
Jones, shout out to you.
I was like, my daddy had that, and Alan was like, duh. And I just was watching it the other night with him, the third episode, and then I read I posted this on the group. I read a theory that was super sold on until I read another theory today, but it's funny how my theory that I read on Vanity Fair, Alan was his theory before he even knew that article existed. So now we're like, I was looking for the perfect show to like marry like what we're interested in, and this is it. So it's really exciting.
Margaret Wappler, what are you all about this week?
I'm all about this memoir that I picked up while I was in Chicago over Christmas break. It's called Love and Trouble, A Midlife Reckoning by Claire Dieterer. Mm. And it is a book that is just hitting me in the direct right spot right now. This is a memoir about a middle-aged woman who's just comfortable in her life. She's married to a deeply kind, equal partner. She's blessed with two healthy children. She has this great writing career, but for some reason, she finds herself up late at night drinking Maker's Mark and thinking about the girl she used to be, who she calls this disastrous pirate slut of a girl. and she feels that girl like creep closer and closer and closer to her until she's breathing down her neck. And it's the kind of woman that you see like in yoga pants walking around Seattle, like holding her like thermos of Starbucks. And you're like, whatever, that bitch has it all figured out. But then it takes that woman and it breaks her down and it shows all her rage and horniness and weirdness that she feels in her own skin. And it just feels so good to me to read right now as a new mother. Like Claire Dieterer has kids that are in their teens, if not older at this point. But I feel what she's feeling in the sense of like one moment I'm speaking in baby talk and, you know, telling David not to swear too much around the baby. And then the next moment I'm like, I really want to get drunk and high and just like, you know, sleep past 7 a.m. Could I do that, please? I recommend this especially for fans of Diablo Cody's Tully, which is playing now on HBO. And if you haven't seen it yet, please do. Because it hits a lot of the same notes of like, what happens to that old self, that girl that existed, often the girl from your 20s, the girl that you kind of want to bury because she was a hot mess. Mm-hmm. But what happens to her when you become a mother or you become a wife or whatever these other things are that you do? Claire Dieterer, some of you guys might know her from this essay of hers that went globally viral called What Do We Do with the Art of Monstrous Men? Mm-hmm. And it's a really important work from the Me Too era, and it basically looks at Woody Allen and, you know, all the rest of the creeps out there who have created a good movie or two.
A universe of creeps.
Yes. One of the essays also in the collection that I really love is called Dear Roman Polanski. And she basically compares what happened to Samantha Gailey, the survivor of the assault from Roman Polanski, and something that happened to Claire right around the same age. And it's this real kind of examination and sort of a certain kind of indictment on the 70s and the dark end of the hippie commune culture and sort of the things that were allowed to happen in the name of being like cool and groovy that ultimately left children like really exposed. I'm so excited for her next book. It's called Monsters. It's a nonfiction book investigating good art made by bad people.
That sounds awesome.
Yeah.
Do you want me to make a dismissive joke?
Please. Well, I wouldn't feel right if you didn't.
Margaret, you ask, what should we do with what are the lives of women who had children and are married? And I think they cease to exist because all of their calcium and soul has gone into the baby so that the men can lead lives and the women can imbue other male babies with souls.
Oh, you're correct. I mean, we're pretty much all just walking around as broken osteoporosis bags, you know, just filling the men of our lives with potential and promise.
That's going to, like, frankly, Guy's quote is going to be pulled for the new Chronicles of Gilead. The new charter.
That went right over my head.
All right. Due to a power sharing agreement that has been negotiated between the representatives of me and Karen Tongson now gets half of an all about. Karen Tongson, what are you half all about this week?
Because Guy Branum totally scooped me on our Google Doc that we share before we prep for the show, I'm going to now talk about the thing that captivated my attention in the last 24 hours. And that is a truly important documentary called Catwalk, Tales from the Cat Show Circuit, which, frankly, this could be a Guy Branum all about because it's about competitive Canadian cat aficionados. And in particular, the compelling thing about it was this rivalry that was fomented between a truly gregarious and, quote, well-muscled Turkish Angora named Bobby, who was leading the points total in the Canadian, or maybe it's international, but who knows, cat circuit, and then who got scooped by the late arrival on the scene of voluminous red Persian named Ooh-la-la.
from the mean streets of Edmonton, no one ever thought that Ooh-la-la could competitively cat, but then there was an older Jewish cat that instructed Ooh-la-la.
A Russian grey. Exactly.
There's also like so much, again, like the tension of these like breeds, these cat breeds that are all like named by their region, their nation. But it's really fundamentally about like these sort of gentle rivalries between like middle-aged Canadian women who train and groom and bring these cats all over to these competitions, which, you know, it's so hilarious because I was at a friend's house this weekend and, you know, we may have like, you know, had a little something to drink and something to eat and all that stuff. And she's like, let's turn this on. And it's like, it said 98% match for her. And then when I went home, it's like 97% match for me that I should watch Catwalk. And you know, honestly, I have to say, I wanted more action from a kind of something that promised cat fashions, cat intensity. But in the end, like what you get is,
you
know,
catwalk.
I did want the catwalk, but frankly,
a cat fights.
But you know, but in the end, there's no such thing in the cat show, cat competition world, because really, like the reason that Ooh-la-la began to take all of these titles is precisely because Ooh-la-la is a Persian, which is very hard to take care of. They're very hairy cats. Like, you have to clean their eyes. You have to brush them. That is not my jam.
No, thank you.
You know, that is not my jam. It is like there was one judge, like in a climactic moment of this documentary, who, like, you know, the owner, Ooh-la-la's owner, whose name I forget, but like was like really nervous because she's like, you know, he's a great lover of Persian cats and he may like judge her more harshly. And he just said,
I have goosebumps. I have goosebumps. 32 years of judging, this is one of the finest cats I've ever judged. 32 years.
Meanwhile, like Bobby, who his owner says, the Turkish Angora, who his owner's like, he's just like a playful, friendly jock who everyone wants to be friends with. Mm. I'm just like, yeah. And Bobby is like
Bobby
a totally...
sounds like the George Bush of cats.
He could be. Or kind of your Channing Tatum of cats, I would say.
Sure. Okay.
So anyway, I'm not going to reveal what happens in the end, you know, for that dramatic tension. For the like 2.5% of you out there who love cats as much as I do, the one thing I have to say, if you are a cat lover but not like a super like intense cat person, some of this might be a little triggering and sad. But in the end, I think it's a fascinating tale of like rivalry, cat breeding, etc.
Speaking of affable jocks that everyone wants to like,
yes.
Karen and I fell in love with a teen series from Britain this week. That's on Netflix. A little something called Sex Education. It stars Asa Butterfield as the son of Gillian Anderson, who is a single mom who is a sex therapist. And a scrappy girl who needs some money at the school, Maeve, convinces him that he should become sex therapist to the students. So it's a little bit, you know, like a teen soap, but it's also a little bit of procedural, where in every episode you are following one C-plot that is him, like our main character, Otis, like helping like high school students through some sexual problem. And it is set in the most magnificent fantasy world that is, they shoot it. I had to look it up. They shoot it. Did you look it up?
I didn't look that part up because, you know.
Because
I just assumed this is what it's like to go to school in England.
But, I mean, the thing is they set it in Wales. Like, they shoot it in Wales. So you've got these sort of, like, dramatic rivers and forests of a sort that, like, seem like it's a show set in Seattle. Like, you never see an England that has that much geography. And also, the high school is, like, made up both of some British tropes. There's a head boy, but he wears a Letterman's jacket and he throws a football, an American football, but like the sport they all care about is swimming. And there are like in Britain, they don't have lockers, but the creators were just so into the teen comedies of essentially the 1980s till today.
Yeah.
It's set in this world that is sort of like a combination of their lived experience of British secondary education and American high school. Like they just go to the tropes of high school movies so much that like when Otis is telling the boy who likes the girl that Otis likes what to study to properly understand her, he just goes through the list of music and reading that was given in 10 Things I Hate About You.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Like, it's stuff like that. The music is all stuff that you love from teen comedies you've watched 1,000 times.
That
Go
is
Karen.
The most brilliant thing about the series is the music supervision is so spot on. And it is actually one of the things that's disorienting about this show is that it took me like the most of the first episode to figure out what period this was actually set in.
Yeah.
Because it seems like, okay, it's contemporary. All the things seem contemporary. Otis has a black best friend, you know, and like black gay best friend.
They have smartphones.
And they have smartphones. Like, but the music, the atmosphere, all of it is very much like the kind of peak John Hughes, you know. Mm. And
that
and,
seems like a very clever way to combine like adults getting a nostalgia hit while watching this, but teenagers now watching it and relating.
Mm-hmm. Did you look at who wrote and directed this show?
Well, Laurie Nunn is the creator of the show. So,
and it's basically like all of the directors I saw were women. All of the writers I saw were women. I don't know if that's entirely true, but it leads to an interesting balance in a show that is so preoccupied with sex. I get annoyed with high school shows being all about sex. That is sort of like what's on the plate here. The thing is there are a lot of kids who are just figuring things out on their own or whatever. But I like the fact that in one episode, a character is going out dressed, not gender conforming. And their dad says,
Eric, you can't go out dressed like this. Go and change.
Dad, it's okay. It's a costume. Otis will be in costume too. We do it every year. It's fine.
Put a coat on. It's not safe.
And the character leaves, blithely dismissing that. And it is dangerous. But the show does not say this person should not have done that. Like, it really is an interesting balance of sort of like understanding it's a dangerous world without judging people or trying to caution them in one direction or another.
Yeah, and at the same time, like, one of the things that's really lovely about it is that it's incredibly sex positive and that it has all of that, like, psychoanalytic nuance that people of this contemporary time can bring to a good old fashioned like teen sex romp, you know. So it's like, you know, in the 80s we used to encounter these things. We used to encounter horn dog teens without like that extra level or layer of college.
Yeah.
And what this does is that it kind of artificially imposes that layer of like, I read Freud 101 in, you know, freshman, sophomore year of college, and then now I can come back to this environment and like say, well, maybe you have this particular like complex or this hang up.
It's got some of the tropes of a teenager has superpowers or teenager has magic powers show, because the superpower that Otis has is his mom's a sex therapist, so he understands these things. So he's having to like hide it from his mom and balance his responsibilities to that with his schoolwork and stuff. And it's really fun. And I really like the fact that neither Otis nor his mom are wonderful, perfect people. She misuses her position as a sex therapist in so many ways, but not in the worst ways. Like in the first episode, she smokes pot with a bad kid, and I was like, oh no, is she going to go in a very bad direction, or is she going to be a paragon of virtue? And she's neither of those things. She's a human being.
Tremendous nuance that I feel like only kind of a British teen sex romp that has 80s vibes but is set in the contemporary moment can pull off. And I mean, this show is one of the things that has truly made me happy in the last few weeks, and that's like hard to do.
Really good. You guys should watch it. I would also like to end by being clear that I had switched my topic to just talking about how good Naomi Smalls was on last week's Drag Race. But, I mean, since our reps had spent so much time figuring out the power-sharing balance between me and Karen, I have to go through with it. But I want everyone at home who watches Drag Race to know that after this recording is done, I'm going to force Margaret Wappler to watch Naomi Smalls lip-sync for her life against Gia Gunn. And then Margaret is going to turn to me and say, How tall is she? Okay. You're listening to Pop Rocket. We're going to be right back to talk about fire after this.
Hi, I am Lori Kilmartin.
And I'm Jackie Cation.
Together, we host a podcast called
The Jackie and Lori Show.
We're both stand-up comics. We recently met each other because women weren't allowed to work together on the road or in gigs for a long, long time. And so our friendship has been unfolding on this podcast for a couple of years. Jackie constantly works the road. I write for Conan, and then I work the road in between.
We do a lot of stand-up comedy, and so we celebrate stand-up, and
yes,
we also bitch about it.
We keep it to an hour. We don't have any guests. We somehow find enough to talk about every single week. So find us. You can subscribe to The Jackie and Lori Show at Maximum Fun. .org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, bye.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Guy Branum. With me in the studio are
Winter Mitchell Rorba,
Margaret Wappler,
and Karen Tongson.
You guys, we have an embarrassment of riches. Where the fuck is Amazon on this? Because we all knew a documentary about Firefest was going to be coming out on Netflix. We were so excited for it. And then a week before it was supposed to happen, Hulu came out with their own Firefest documentary that actively talks shit about the Netflix documentary.
Fuck Jerry.
Before we get into any of this, let's just open up with, like, was this not a magnificent coup for Hulu? And are you sad that you watched the Hulu one first?
I'm not in the slightest bit sad that I watched the Hulu one first because, frankly, I feel it is the superior documentary. I'll lay it down from the very beginning because the Hulu documentary, to me, was unsullied by the fact that the Fuck Jerry people and some of the investors in Firefest were not part of the production, which the Netflix doc was kind of sullied by. Like, the Hulu doc builds a case and creates a whole narrative around the concept of fraud and culpability and distributes it among the many people who were involved in that. And it does not absolve anyone of their culpability. And that's why when I saw that and then saw the Netflix doc afterwards, I was just like, okay, like, this one seems to kind of soft shoe around things and has better footage from the inside, but the Netflix one, but the Hulu one, I think, frankly, gives us the best framework in which to understand the Fire Festival.
To clarify, the original sin of the Hulu documentary is that they paid $250,000.
Well, they've said that it wasn't that much.
Okay. To Billy McFarland, the guy who was this sort of core fraudster of Firefest, and then the Netflix documentary was produced by Fuck Jerry.
Vice Media.
Yeah, but Fuck Jerry was a marketing corporation that was involved, like basically did all of this magnificent marketing for Firefest and had shit tons of footage of all of this stuff happening. Margaret, which did you prefer?
Well, it's interesting because I had a different experience in that I watched the Netflix one first.
Oh.
Because I watched it on the Friday that it came out. And I laughed uproariously at it. And it was super fun and entertaining to me until it got to the end, basically. And I think what a note that it hit that I think was missing for me from the Hulu documentary was the devastation that this whole scam caused for the Bahamians, which to me are like the people that I feel the saddest for. Like, I mean, I know that everyone always says the people who went to Firefest were a bunch of rich kids, but that's been said not to be true many times, that there were actual kids that, you know, kind of like saved up money to buy a ticket and they weren't necessarily rich and they just, you know, leveraged as much as they had to get this. And I feel bad for those kids, but I feel worse for these people that basically worked, you know, provided free labor for like 6+ months or whatever it was. But, you know, I think for me, I would really recommend watching both of them, and I feel like they fascinatingly fit together like puzzle pieces. Like, one illuminates points that the other one misses. Like, I think it's like a think piece, which is the Hulu, and versus the procedural, which is the Netflix. Well, like, I think the procedural one shows you the breakdown of the actual event much better, but the Hulu one pulls it out and gives it much more of a broad context.
Like, the Hulu documentary has a thesis. It doesn't have a lot of footage. They use some of the same B-roll,
so
like
B-roll,
four or five times, where the Netflix documentary has lots of lush footage of blue water and pigs swimming around, but it doesn't really have anything that clear to say. Winter, what order did you watch them in?
I watched the Hulu one first, and then I watched Netflix when it came out.
And which did you prefer?
Hulu. I feel like Netflix is not a poor comparison. I think Netflix is just as good. It's just the second of the two. I felt like Hulu... It's one of those situations where, like, who am I rooting for? And I just don't know who to root for.
And the thing about the Netflix documentary that bothered me was that, like, half the time they seem to be going, or was he a genius?
Or that part of it I fucking hated.
But I don't think the doc was saying that. I think the people that were working with him was saying that.
But I mean, but the doc was made by those people, and so much of the doc was those, like, the Netflix documentary is these cool guys who are cool talking about how they were making this cool thing, and well, then we started to be uncertain. Where, like, the Hulu documentary is more a biography of Billy McIntyre's fraud.
Right.
McFarlane.
He's not even interesting enough to be named.
Billy McIntyre was a guy that I went on a couple of dates with who was eventually on an episode of Sex Sent Me to the ER.
Of course.
Details.
I did feel like watching Hulu, having a sense of, like, where... in New Jersey, this kid came from, and the various shit he had pulled, and the way that...
From elementary school onward.
Right. I mean, the greatest crime in this entire thing is the way that he pronounced the words crayon. Mm-hmm. He said crayon, and I wanted to hit him because that was one of his earlier ventures involved crayons. But I felt like it really was an interesting contemplation of the way that the Silicon Valley bubble mentality has sort of... merged with Instagram ability to create a situation where everyone is really excited to have a lie sold to them. Mm-hmm. Like, Kendall Jenner is a lie. We understand that all of these Instagram stars' lives are a fictionalization of what life could be, and everybody was getting the temptation that they could go to this island and they were going to shoot photos with two models, blue water, a pig was going to nipple on their foot, and then everyone would envy them.
Well, I mean, actually, you know, when I was watching both of these, I wanted to hear from Winter about, like, this social media team and the fact that this was something that was forged from a social media phenomenon, right? Like, that was framed in both documentaries. I think the Hulu one did a little bit of a better job in, like, suggesting some culpability again with that, like, Jerry Media. But, like, you know... I just wonder, as a professional in that field, like, when do you draw the line? When would one draw the line around, like, this shit's fucked up, I can't pimp for it anymore?
I mean, they didn't ask for a lot from people. They paid each influencer seduce them with one post. And that's the innocuous sort of, like, naivete about social media, is that...
Right, they're basically like, post this orange tile and we'll throw a bunch of money at you.
Exactly.
Cool.
Huh? If someone asked me to do that, I would not check if they were anti-Semites or homophobes.
I mean,
it's just the easiest
2 seconds you've ever done in your life.
That's the thing that I feel like Firefest was a turning point for a lot of these scenarios, because it was so innocuous to just say, post this orange tile. I remember the day that it showed up. I really didn't know what it was. And I also had that... sense of FOMO. Like, why didn't I know that this was happening? And it's happening in mass to the point that everybody's talking about it. And the problem with them in this instance is it wasn't even 48 hours before people were like, this thing is in trouble. Like, so that's when I was immediately like, thank God. Literally, I remember the day I was like, thank God nobody asked me to participate in this.
I love that. Even watching the Hulu documentary, which is the less glossy of them, I was still like, I would like to go to this thing. I hate music festivals, and it did such a good job of making me feel like I want to go to this thing.
If it was chill.
And the The hard thing about it is that, like, when it comes to event planning, everything looks like it's not going to happen until it happens. I mean, dinner parties.
Yes, no, that's true.
No, like, but the thing is like, Coachella doesn't overpromise and underdeliver. It tells you, these are the people that are going to be there. Heineken's the sponsor.
Yeah.
These are the stages. We might have hamburgers. We can't guarantee the Angus or otherwise, but this is what's happening. The problem with this festival is it was giving you the ultimate experience. You just want to land at the airport, private airport or whatever, like little drama. You want to get to your villa and chill, have a few drinks, go see the opener act on Friday, Saturday, Sunday, hang out with bitches. And it's like, that wasn't promised. It was marketed to them, but it wasn't promised upon landing. That wasn't what was happening.
It's interesting because I think in a way, which one you prefer comes down to how much culpability you would put on Jerry Media and the other influencers and marketing team. And to me, I guess I'm not, like, as a person who was a copywriter in my former life and have been part of marketing campaigns, like, you really don't know what's going on the other side of those campaigns. Mm-hmm. Like, if they tell you that the festival is being built, like, you know it's being built. And I feel like the only person in the Hulu documentary that goes against Jerry Media is the guy that had an acrimonious split with them. So to me, that's like not a very verifiable like interview. You know what I mean? That's like a disgruntled employee saying, yeah, they knew. And like at the same time, to me, it's like a bigger problem that the documentary paid for an interview with Billy McFarland. And that interview is bullshit. I mean, he reveals nothing. Well, like there is nothing of value in that interview. But he like just completely snows it, and they're willing to give him all this money. They're basically willing to sort of give a con artist more money to tell his conned out story.
But he incriminates himself multiple times over in his quote unquote testimony in that documentary.
How so?
I think that I feel like you, because of the way that the documentary is already framed around this guy as being someone who was dubiously a talent from the very beginning, or a quote-unquote genius from the very beginning. The Netflix documentary like lingers on the possibility of his genius much longer than the Hulu one does. It completely, from the get-go, it suggests that he was somebody who just figured out how to game a system.
Well, I think the Netflix one basically takes the point of view of the people who are working for him. Like the people who kind of went, you know, Billy McFarland has all this energy and these great ideas. Maybe he's a genius, maybe he's a comment. I don't know.
I know.
And I think it kind of took that point of view and ran with it.
But it also glances aside from sort of the grossest thing that they were doing, which the Hulu documentary really focuses on, which is the period of time when they were just searching keywords and deleting those things. And it really is the thing that is most insidious, is people just sort of like at cubicles ending communication about things that could like make people aware of potential problems.
I wish that the Hulu one had just stated very clearly in the doc that they paid him for the interview.
Yeah.
I think that really makes a big difference.
That would have made a difference. But I do.
To me, it makes a big difference. I feel like journalistically, that's just like rule one. You paid somebody for an interview who's a con man that you're like focusing this whole thing on. You need to say it.
The real answer would be to agree to pay him and then just give the money to the Bahamian lady and say, fucking sue me, Billy.
Yeah. I mean, I do think that Ja Rule is sort of the secondary character that doesn't get smoked enough as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
Like, this guy clearly knew that some bullshit was going down in that call. And now I'm getting confused. I think it was in the Netflix one, but I can't quite remember.
I think it's the Hulu duck that smokes Ja Rule a little more intensely at the end.
I think you're right, but there's this moment where you hear the phone call, the day after phone call, where Ja Rule is like, no, man, we just spin this. Like, we don't, you know.
Yeah.
And somebody's like, isn't this fraud? And he's like, it's false advertising.
But it's not fraud. But the thing about Ja Rule
those things are the same.
Ja Rule is this really sort of also, to me, in my opinion, just exemplifies how people end up being musicians. The moment they become famous, or the way they get into the industry, that's just sort of like the path they continue on, and it's not about aggregating like any other education that would support them. They really made a fool out of Ja Rule in the Netflix one. They showed how he just kind of went along with the ride, went along for the ride because it gave, he wanted to be a mogul.
Yeah.
Well, and also so many people have had such good success stories with becoming the face of something.
Yeah.
And, you know.
But not recently. And that's what I don't understand about Ja Rule in particular, compared to who he's aligned with. Like, there's no one who's in his world, if black rapper, who's a considered like a mogul. He's trying to reach like Jay-Z levels, mm-hmm. and Jay-Z, we're talking about 20
it's just
40
laughable
years
that he would even try.
20 well, years of like creating
get rich quick scheme,
not like 20 years of creating a legacy and sort of like letting it kind of bend with the title of it all, and he's just jumping out here with this dude being like, we're gonna start a Coachella.
Well, I mean, I think
come on.
Like the interesting racism of their friendship and relationship,
yes.
was two people looking at stereotypes.
It like, was 48 hours and white men can't jump.
Yeah, it was like, here's this cool guy, he's got so much cool,
yeah,
I will leverage his cool. And like, here's this smart business guy. He'll smart business and turn my cool into profit.
Right.
And you
either
know,
one was dumb about the other.
The magic bird is a phrase that me and Billy coined. The impact that Magic Johnson and Larry Bird had on the NBA changed the way people saw and thought about basketball. And me and Billy are gonna change the way people look at a young tech entrepreneur and a hip hop mogul come together and create something incredible.
The thing that is so like galling, particularly about the Netflix documentary.
You paid $1,500 for Ja Rule's contact information. I have his cell number on my phone. No, like I mean, that right there.
How he kept the Ponzi going at the beginning. I'm still like the whole ticket game, but
I don't get it while watching the Netflix
documentary. I kept being like, it kept reminding you that if they had just run this thing at a loss in the first year, if they had underprovided what people were asking for, or if they had just paid $6 million for the food instead of trying to do it for $1 million and in the end just having that cheese sandwich, which is indelibly
you
like,
mean if Andy just sucked dick for the water?
Oh my god, Andy, guys, is gay icon or gay icon?
Explain
I mean,
who
on.
Andy is to the people who haven't
Andy,
seen.
Andy, at first glance, seems like the only adult in the room, yes. according to the Netflix documentary, where he like comes to save the day. He is an old pal of Billy's.
He's an event planner.
Knows what he's doing, ostensibly.
But refers to all of these people as children the entire
all
time.
All the time. Kids. Oh, I felt bad for the kids. And at one point when things are really, shit's really hitting the fan, Billy apparently makes a phone call to ask Andy if he can take one for the team.
And I said, oh my gosh, I've been taking something for the team every day. He said, well, you're our wonderful gay leader and we need you to go down. Will you suck dick to fix this water problem? And I said, Billy, what? He said, Andy, if you will go down and suck Cunningham's dick, who's the head of customs, and get him to clear all of the containers with water, you will save this festival. And I literally drove home, took a shower. I drank some mouthwash. I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm really, and I got into my car to drive across the island to take one for the team. And I got to his office fully prepared to suck his dick.
Oh, Andy.
My poor boo. Well,
two points. The first is the truly great Danielle Perez. I forget whether she's guested on the show before or not, but she is a stand-up comedian. She had altered a screen from Bandersnatch so that the choices were suck dick for Avion or no, don't take one for the team. And,
Danielle, we love
brilliant.
You.
Brilliant.
It was so good. But more than that, the thing I loved about the whole Avion situation and the alcohol situation was we talk about white privilege, but the extent to which these people all forgot the Bahamas is another country.
Yeah.
Like, it was just this deeply colonial sense that we get to stomp anywhere we want to stomp.
Yes.
And do whatever
America's
we want to do.
America's plaything.
Yeah, and that they had no sense that, like, there was going to be a 50% fucking duty on their liquor, that they were going to have to pay, like, $900,000.
Or a national regatta.
Yeah.
That's the thing.
Right.
That was the thing.
Just
that,
look
like,
up the Bahamian tour guide schedules, like,
the
on the internet, and you can figure that one out.
When you talk about like how the Netflix one got the like I suppose featured some of the people who were Bohemian people who were swindled. Like, the thing about the Hulu doc for me was that it framed from the very beginning that, like, there was a complete and utter ignorance around what the Bahamas were in that space. And there were, like, maybe not a proliferation of people, but people who were very incisive about saying, like, look, we said there's this regatta. There'll be, like, you know, 90% occupancy in all of the, like, hotels. Like, you're not going to get flights here. Like, that's the one of the things that I believe, like, where the Netflix doc, like, sentimentalized some of the individual stories, the Hulu doc got the structural issues down and, like, laid those things down through the people who were commenting in a particular way. And you know, I mean, not that, like, look, I think these two things should be seen together. I think that they are companion pieces.
Yeah.
In the end, nothing and no one is going to win. There was a Rocketeer who tweeted at us who said, just make sure you watch both of them, which is obviously what our thematic is here tonight. But it's like, you know, that fundamentally, like, that's what we're talking about. It's like there was a whole, like, lack of cultural knowledge and experience, and also, like, at what point in the shit show do you say stop?
The saddest thing about it is that it really was the budget pass to paradise. The thing is that when you're following these people on Instagram who are famous, who do show up to, like, a beautiful little bungalow and then go have a small private performance by somebody amazing and then go off to their gourmet meal. Like, you see that and you understand that as real personhood. And Billy was giving sort of a perfectly toned lie in that way of saying, for just $1,500, you're going to get these seven photos that are really going to prove that you're on top of things.
It also has this interesting confluence with, like, Gen X values at the same time, where it's like, I mean, music festivals as we know them now are completely a Gen X creation. Yeah. You know what I mean? Coachella, Lollapalooza, the failed Woodstock, the second one. You know, all of these things basically set the oven for him to bake his own little
preheated
fucked up...
it.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you. For him to, like, you know, make his own little creation, and it's, like, mixed with this millennial, though, FOMO idea and the idea that you can just, like, turn it up to the max. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's not good enough to have, like, you know, glamping on the grounds of Indio, so forth and so on. You have to have Bella Hadid, like, giving you a massage in a cabana.
Well, okay, two things. First of all, I think millennials were taught from childhood that they should professionalize all of their activities.
Yes.
They're coked up, sort of like high on money parents.
MDMA'd up, not coke.
Yes. their parents. Their parents in the 1980s. Oh. Coked up, Karen.
Okay.
Like, convinced them that it was like, go all out. Like, we're taking you to all of these classes. We're going to overschedule you, but you're already a professional little person. Where we Gen Xers were left to raise ourselves and be abducted, and we never imagined we could do such things. But we also have a caller with a millennial perspective for us.
During the Fyre doc on Hulu, The Fyre Fraud, explaining the promotional video, Emily, the one woman who used to work for Magnesa, says, and all these, like, really hot models are dancing around, and then there's, like, random white guys there for who knows what reason. And then it immediately cuts over to Oliver saying, beautiful women on a deserted island? Yeah, 100% I'm going. And honestly, I know that part was kind of buried and maybe functioned as a punchline, but really, that's millennial culture to me. I can't wait to hear what you guys have to say about it. And if you found this part stood out to you as much as it did to me. And thanks so much.
Well, I mean, I think part of what she's getting at is that the campaign to promote Fyre Festival was super bro-y. I mean, it was appealing directly to bros. Like, these are going to be the girls that will dance all around you. And basically, you're going to be the pig in the water that they're playing with.
The magic is having a curated scene. The magic is being able to show up and have a vacation, but also have everyone there be cool. Which is why the caller's, like, point is so interesting, that, like, our notion of temptation is so gendered.
Yeah.
That, like, it really is about there being hot women there. And I just wonder, like, is it tempting to you? Like, is it tempting to women when you see this vision of, like, Bella Hadid frolicking on a beach.
Hell no.
I mean,
but it's not my like taste. It's not my aesthetic. You know what I mean? Like it just, it, like the whole vibe of it.
Yeah,
I mean, same. And I didn't know about Firefest until it was going wrong. But like once I saw that video, I was like, yeah, not for me. But I would have gone as a press person. Would have loved.
The only thing that I would like, I was just like, really, I could swim with pigs.
You're right. Yeah,
really,
that part.
Literally would have been it for me. Like, you know, cat show person here.
Yeah.
But like, you know, that even as a sapphic person, I wouldn't have been like seduced by that vision of like dead-eyed modeldom on white beaches, you know, and like, and then like knowing that it would be accompanied by those random bros, as the caller said, in the background, like showing off like their, you know, ungroomed like upper pubic hair peeking out of their board shorts.
None of them were hot.
Yeah, exactly. None of that would have been cool.
But the thing is also.
Period. That is that. No one fuckable on this fake parking lot island.
I have to tell you, my reaction would have been like, I looked at those the drawings of tents, and I was like, cool. And then I was immediately like, but is there air conditioning? Which
exactly. It's just like comfort. Like, I want a villa, but if villa means $15,000.
Well, it is fascinating how many of them went to just total mayhem once they didn't have a, you know, better than FEMA level tent.
Yeah. Like, P.S. It shows my literal lack of like, I will rough it, that I was like, I'm fine with the FEMA tents if I'm going to see.
I know, not like, that bad. But also like the guy that was like, yeah, me and all my friends like peed on the mattresses so that no one would like be around us. Like, what is wrong with you?
Yeah, that is so deeply evil. It's just like, it is like neoliberalism to its extreme extent. It's like, I'm an individual. I'm an island. You can't be near me.
I'm looking out for me and me only. Yeah.
No, like the fact that they went from this such a community oriented entrance to everyone just becoming libertarians, like hoarding mattresses
and
peeing.
Yeah. Cheap ass rum. Hoarding pallets.
Well, that's the other part. Let me tell you something. And Karen, thank you for bringing that part up. If you haven't been to the Virgin Islands or Bahamas, you know that they dilute the fuck out of their shit. So when you get there, it's like you're steadily trying to catch a buzz, and they just want you to go into town and buy the rum because that's their biggest export. But then you land there and it's really just like you're literally chasing a buzz like you're in Park City. It's like the biggest mistake of this entire thing that was clarified in Netflix docs, not in Hulu, is that there was a bar upon landing. And I was like, honestly, I literally Denzel Washington memed when, whew, because I was like, thank God
my reaction was, could I have
like
made
lemonade? Euthanasia thing.
Yeah.
Could I have made lemonade from this? Could I have just been, it's drunk and there are if it were the people that I wanted to be around.
Yeah.
Because
I don't know what's worse, knowing later that you don't have a place to sleep or knowing upon landing.
Because I, like, as a gay person, I do really understand this need to sort of like have enough of a revolutionary cadre of the people you need to be with for a vacation to be worthwhile.
Yes.
I have gone on vacation in Caribbean. Like, there's one place where you can go in the Caribbean and be gay, and that's like San Juan, Puerto Rico. And other than that, you're having a different kind of good time. And I do understand that. And I think about the way that just like an AIDS hotel that is 3/4 full of gay guys and 1/4 full of family with children, I can have a fucking good time. And I like wanted that for these people.
Yeah, me too.
But I have to ask
that's
you.
So generous.
If we were to see a narrative film about something like this, who would you want to see direct a film about?
I thought
Fire
you wanted
Fest.
To know about the cast, because I have a cast.
Oh, give me your cast.
Viola Davis is Marianne.
Oh, yes. Fully.
Tiffany Haddish is just ambient.
Uh-huh.
Idris Elba is Delroy, deadass.
Yes.
No, I want Tiffany Haddish as the most angry person on the bus.
Yes! Yes!
I want her as the voice of the Greek chorus.
Want her to be credited. I just want her to show up.
Yeah.
Julia Roberts is that one investor that
oh my God.
That was just sort of
that
like flitting
the
around.
The one who was just like in leggings all the time.
Yeah,
like has some money.
No one knows what happened to her.
Margot Robbie as his girlfriend.
Uh-huh. Oh yeah.
Leonardo DiCaprio as Billy McFarlane. The only reason I would say that, my alternative is Joseph Gordon-Levitt. I think Joseph Gordon-Levitt would do a really good job. I think Leonardo DiCaprio would give it gravitas. I think it should be Joseph Gordon-Levitt. I don't know. I just think he's an amazing actor, and he just knows what he's doing when he's doing it. And then I think that it should be narratively, like how the storyline should be. Like, one part, 200 cigarettes. Okay, one part cabin in the woods, and then one part can hardly wait.
Anybody else?
Well, I really like the Pop Rocket listener who suggested, it was Madeline Ryder. She tweeted that she'd like to see Werner Herzog for her version.
Yeah.
And I'm like, his narration alone would be a thing of wonder and beauty.
That would be amazing. All right, let's hear from James from Texas.
I feel like the only real answer is Jordan Peele. I would love to see some sort of noir horror version of Firefest by, like, I'm thinking maybe some people left behind on the island and they can't get off. Anyway, love your show. Would love to know your thoughts. Thank you so much.
I like the horror element of what he's pitching. Here's what I want. I want Sofia Coppola to direct something that is midway in between Lord of the Flies and Cloverfields, just like a girl showing up and, like, at night things do turn to real chaos and there are gangs involved. But I want that Sofia Coppola level of, we're willing to watch and be engaged with the third most involved person here, who's probably not going to say that much and is just trying to make it back to that plane.
But you know who's, like, perfect for this and who's been doing this for 25, 30 plus years?
Who?
Harmony.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. That is what Jen J. Walker said. Again, our, like, rock star rocketeer on Twitter was like, Harmony Korine should do this. The other thing that I would suggest is that either Louis Vertel play Andy.
Louis would do such a good job.
Or if we wanted to go, like, real, like, kind of, like, dodgy actor, it would be, or more method, it would totally be Crispin Glover.
No, I really wanted to be Channing Tatum in that role as well.
Well, Channing Tatum, like, could play a great Billy McFarlane.
Yeah, he could play a great Billy. Or, like, a young Josh Brolin.
I mean,
young Josh Brolin would be great.
Your earlier comments about Channing Tatum do not respect the quirk that is inherent to him.
Also, James Franco has to be involved in some kind of shape or form.
Absolutely. I mean,
he would be all of Fuck Jerry.
Yes. Amalgamation.
He would just
in
play
one
like
person.
Quadruplets just, that like, all work.
Hey guys, I'm Fuck Jerry.
So it's basically like Vice level transformation technology, but also the clumps.
Yes.
Like,
I need it. I need it. I need it because I need it.
All right, you guys, you're listening to Pop Rocket. We're gonna be right back after this.
Hi, I'm Allie Gertz.
And I'm Julia Prescott, and we're the hosts of Everything's Coming Up, Simpsons. Every episode, we cover a different episode of The Simpsons that is a favorite of our special guests.
We've had guests that are showrunners and writers and voice actors like Nancy Cartwright.
I got a D-minus, I passed!
And we've also had people that are on the Max Fun Network already.
We've had Weird Al Yankovic on the show.
I was just struck by how sharp the writing is. I mean, that's no surprise because it's The Simpsons, but I mean, like, you can't say that about a lot of TV shows, particularly ones that at that point had been on the air for 14 years.
Find us on MaximumFun.org, iTunes, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, smell you later.
Pop Rocket is sponsored in part by Care Of. Do something good for your health in 2019. Care Of makes it easy to stick to your health-related resolutions. Care Of's fun online quiz asks you about your diet, health goals, and lifestyle choices, and it takes only 5 minutes. Care Of delivers daily vitamins and supplement packets customized to your recommendations. A portion of every sale goes to the Good Plus Foundation, which provides expectant mothers in need with valuable prenatal vitamins. Take advantage of this month's special New Year offer. For 50% off your first month of personalized Care Of vitamins, go to takecareof.com and enter ROCKET50. Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Guy Branum. With me in the studio are...
Winter Mr. Roba.
Margaret Wappler.
And Karen Tongson.
Every week on Pop Rocket, we ask our panel, what's your current jam? Winter Mitchell, what's your current jam?
I was listening to this. This is another KCRW special. There's nothing really super special about it because it's super old. But Phil Collins had Woo. I'm Not Moving remix by the Idjutes Boys, who are just like these residential DJs out of North London. And they just did something kind of fun with it. I like it.
Damn, Phil Collins' voice can sound so sensual.
Can I tell you, when he dies, I'm going to be real sad.
That, I mean, like,
you know what? Me too. Even yes. though, like, there are certain songs like Susudio that I could never hear again.
It's just he was.
And I'm sorry I even
so
said it, because now it's like a black bat just flying around in this room, like, hurting everyone.
As a person raised in the 1980s, I think all songs should be sung at the other end of a glass hallway.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, man, his shit, like, but just that voice, it's just like, it's like.
He's enjoying everything, every note.
It's encapsulated between eras. It's just
yeah.
like.
Yeah.
It's like, it's got like that falsetto of Peter Cetera, but also yeah. all that radiance of like 70s soft boys. It's so good.
And knowing that he's drumming all the while.
Yeah. Yeah.
That shit.
Karen Tongson, hath thou a jam?
I do have a jam, and it's, you know, a consolation jam from having watched Bohemian Rhapsody, the movie, which, but this was one of the songs that wasn't featured in it, but it reminded me of the beauty and genius of Queen, and it is from their 1980 album, Play the Game, and it's the title song, Play the Game. Don't play hard to get, it's a free world. This is not in the movie, but it's an amazing song, and it just reminds us of like how much that they really, you know, one of the few things that the movie Bohemian Rhapsody did is remind us how they toyed with all these genres like opera, musical theater, and all those tight harmonies, and Play the Game as late in their careers as it was, I mean, or mid in their careers as it was, like really indicated like just how masterful they were at doing this kind of thing.
If people are digging into their Queen, I would also encourage them to just check out the Flash Gordon soundtrack.
Yeah.
Because it really is, it veers into like early video game like yeah. Soundtrack sounds.
Yeah.
It is pretty good. That's a great pick.
You can't go bad with that.
Margaret Wampler, you got a gem?
I have a jam, and I have to thank our Rocketeer, Miguel Lopez Amato, for this one, because he recommended it to me like a few months ago. He tweeted at me that Rosalia has a new album out called El Mal Quiere, and I wasn't really familiar with her, although I'd heard a little tiny bit, and so I sat down pretty much right away and listened, because I trust his taste, and it is a beautiful record. It's this smoky, kind of slinky mix of flamenco, R&B, just really detailed, beautiful pop. She has an amazing voice that just soars over these sometimes like experimental kind of weird compositions, but it always comes back to this like pop accessible place. And this is one of her songs, like probably the lead single from the album called Malamente. This song also marks one of the few times that Kourtney Kardashian and I share a preferred taste, because she shared this on her networks, but don't let that dissuade you.
It's beautiful. It's awesome.
Isn't it?
Shocking.
She has flavor?
You got
somebody told her.
Out
of respect for my vow that I was not going to have any cop-out jams, I have started listening to... Spotify, so that it will suggest things to me.
Nice.
And
yes.
This week,
it's a good way to get in.
Mm-hmm. Welcome to 2015, guys.
Karen, I'll hit you. An old friend of mine had some beautiful work. Let's hear it. Gonna save her now. It's Miley and Mark Ronson never forgetting her fucking roots, never forgetting that she is Dolly Parton's goddaughter.
I was going to say, this has some Dolly all up in it.
And the thing I love about her like place of entitlement within our world of celebrity and music is that she does have... like, she will pull this shit along and bring it into the world of, you know, deeply refined pop that, look, at the end of the day, I do just want a Swedish computer to write all of my songs. But if Miley Cyrus decides that she's going to put some horsey goodness in there, I'm down for it. You've been listening to Pop Rocket, hosted by me, Guy Brandon, with Margaret Wappler, Winter Mitchell Rohrbaugh, and Karen Tongson, the author of Why Karen Carpenter Matters, available for pre-order wherever books are pre-ordered. Our theme music is Party Booby Trap by Ozzy Mizo. Thanks to him for letting us use it. Thanks to everyone for the 5-star reviews in iTunes. If you haven't already, please review us. Did you hear how clear and ringing Margaret's voice was this week? Because you guys have been doing
I
your job.
I feel so good.
She's healed.
Drew in LA said, this is just a wonderful group of smart, funny, very woke people who are a joy to listen to each week as they deconstruct elements of pop culture. I listen to this right away each week and love hearing their recommendations of TV shows, music, movies, etc., as well as comparing notes on stuff I've already consumed. It's totally one of my favorite podcasts. Next week on the show, we'll convene for another official meeting of the Pop Rocket Seal of Approval Committee.
Uh-oh.
As you recall...
No.
Winter nominated Terry Crews, so each of us will either cast a yay or nay vote. If you want to try and influence the proceedings, you can call in and make the case for or against Crews. The number to call in is 530-237-4108. My only worry is that the Pop Rocket will be closed because we can't agree on funding, and we'll have to do it outside like the State of the Union. Get in touch with us on Twitter. We're at Pop Rocket, or join on our Facebook group and get in the discussion. We are a production of MaximumFun.org. Our show is edited by Shana Deloria, who seemed very enthusiastic about the world. And our senior producer is Laura Swisher, who really has had better days.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.